From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. Arisha, let me ask you something. Who's the most famous person who went to your high school?
Oh, that's easy. Me.
Well, I think our guest today has you beat. His name is William Cohen, and his high school bestie was John F. Kennedy Jr. They went to Phillips Academy Andover together, Andover for short. A lot of people consider it to be the best high school in America. It's produced Nobel Prize winners, captains of industry, and two U.S. presidents.
And William.
Yeah, he did pretty well for himself. He spent nearly two decades working in finance before becoming a full-time writer. Now, he's published bestsellers about Wall Street and contributed to magazines like Vanity Fair and The Atlantic. But we're talking to him today because he wrote this really moving book called Four Friends about his friendships with John and three other Andover classmates who all died tragically young.
I know. I read it.
Yeah, but the audience hasn't.
Well, audience, you should get excited. It's not every day you get to hear an interview with a guy who smoked pot with JFK Jr.
And who really got to know him during his formative years.
I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Well, hi, William. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Where are you guys?
Well, I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay. Yep.
And I am in Maryland.
And I'm in upstate New York, so.
Oh, nice.
East Coast, yeah.
Yeah, you go.
All right. So, William, you wrote a beautiful book called Four Friends about four friends of yours, all of whom tragically died young. And you met them at Andover, the boarding school you attended in Massachusetts. But it's not your average high school, is it? Can you kind of talk about that?
No, it's definitely not your average high school for any number of reasons. You know, the kids were from all over, not only all over the country, but, you know, all over the world. It was extremely diverse and ecumenical. The physical plant itself looked like an Ivy League college. The athletic facilities were beyond. And, of course, my brethren, my classmates were extraordinary. As were the teachers. So, I mean, all around, it was quite an eye-opener for me, especially going there as a very young 13-year-old coming from central Massachusetts.
So one of the friends you made at Andover was obviously John F. Kennedy Jr. Do you remember the first time you saw him on campus?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. So John came as an upper, what we would normal people call juniors, but at Andover they're called uppers. And he was in my dorm. And the reason he was in my dorm was because my dorm was next to the Andover Inn, which was, you know, a real thriving inn on campus. And the reason they wanted that was so the Secret Service could sort of tuck away in the basement of the Andover Inn and be able to get to John, you know, if need be, you know, very quickly. Because John was under 16 when he came to Andover. And, you know, you only had Secret Service protection until you were, you know, 16 or at the end of your 16th year. And so I remember, you know, our dorm was sort of down this little hill, and you know, the path from the road up above, you know, went down a hill. And so I remember, of course, seeing Jackie and John come down the hill towards the dorm. And of course, now by this time, we knew that John was not only coming to Andover, but was going to be in our dorm. And I was his, you know, I was one of his two, what are called blue key advisors, seniors who, you know, whose job it was to sort of welcome him to the school and, you know, answer any questions for him and make him feel comfortable as possible. So, you know, seeing Jackie and John come down that hill, I mean, was just, you know, and you have to understand, I grew up in a home where my mother revered Jackie for her style, for her elegance, for her ability to withstand all of the pain and drama that she withstood. So to see her and John in the flesh was really unforgettable.
Yeah, I imagine. Now, can you tell us about the friendship that you and John developed? Are there any memories that really stand out?
Oh, sure. There are a lot of memories. I mean, look, and you know, on the one hand, he was just a completely regular guy and sort of fit into the community very quickly because he was so gregarious and so outgoing and so friendly and so fun. I mean, really, that was the thing. He was a lot of fun. And then you combine that with just this incredible physical presence of being somebody like, you know, you've never seen before in your life, and with all the star power that he had being the son of the martyred president and who grew up in the White House. I mean, there were things like, one time the aforementioned Secret Service at like 10 o'clock at night, long after we were supposed to be in our rooms, in the dorm, took us, John and I, to the next town over, Lawrence, to John was hungry, of course. John had, insatiable appetites. So he, rang up the Secret Service, and of course they do what he wanted them to do, even though it was against the rules, and we could have been thrown out, of course. So we went over to this restaurant called Bishop's, was this great sort of Lebanese Middle Eastern restaurant, and we just pigged out on hummus and pita and, falafel. I mean, it was totally innocent, but also completely against the rules and would have gotten us, expelled. Other times, I remember meeting him in Boston once on the weekend to go to a bar. And we were both underage. And we went to this bar called the Black Rose, which had been a favorite of his father's. So you go in and there's all these photographs of the president and the senator, on the walls. And of course, John walks in and immediately they, can't believe what's going on. And of course, then I can't believe what's going on because they're literally fawning over him, which was, of course, a very typical thing. Whenever you went out in public with John, it was just, it was incredibly exciting and interesting and, the people that he would meet and run into and that would want to be around him. I mean, it was just, as I said, a lot of fun.
Now, something that stuck out to me about John's time at Andover is that he tried a lot of things like sports, acting, studying, but he never really excelled at any of them. Is that fair to say?
Let's see. He certainly didn't excel at academics. He was incredibly physical, but, did not excel in athletics. I would say he excelled in acting. He excelled at fun and partying. Yeah. So I wouldn't say he didn't, those are all important components of life in high school. So, he hit a lot of the important buttons, but not all of them.
Yeah, he was quite a partier, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And, but again, he wasn't, alone. He was certainly more of a partier than I was. I was more of a scaredy cat. Although with him, I ended up trying things that I wouldn't have done with other people. Because again, it was sort of fun and it was with John. The 70s, especially the early 70s when I was there, it was sort of an anything goes kind of culture, and in part because, we had just merged with Abbott Academy, the girls' school, so trying to integrate the girls into the boys' school and, sort of the last thing they could sort of catch up with was the drinking and the pot, the marijuana smoking and things like that. And by the way, the pot sucked at that time, it's not like today. So, it was a time of experimentation, as high school is, believe me, they tried to monitor this and police it, and if you were blatant about it, especially second or third time, you're going to get tossed. Except, of course, if you were John, and then there's under no circumstances were you getting kicked out of Andover.
Right, yeah. Now, so one area where John did excel was being a daredevil. Where do you think that thrill-seeker nature came from?
Well, I think it's definitely a Kennedy-esque trait, right? So there's that. How many of them died doing daredevil-y things on the ski slopes or whatever? And I think John had an even extra dose of that. You have to understand, like, for any number of reasons, the normal rules did not apply to this guy, right?
Right.
So he was incredibly handsome, incredibly charming, you know, incredibly sexy. So, you know, animal magnetism was like no one else. And then he was the son of the martyred president. So, everybody felt that they knew him. Everybody felt that he was part of their lives. So he got a pass on everything. I mean, not that he was stupid or, you know, but, you know, he didn't have to apply himself like other people. He was quite smart, but I mean, you know, you're telling me he's not going to get into Andover if he wants to go to Andover. He's not going to get into Harvard if he wants to go to Harvard or Brown or whatever. You know, he's not going to get a job, in the DA's office after law school if he wants to. I mean, come on, he's not going to go work, you know, out on a ranch in Wyoming for, you know, one of the founders of the Grateful Dead. I mean, look, this daredevil aspect comes from the fact that he did not believe the normal rules of life applied to him. And he had good reason for that, because everything just came without thinking to him. Whatever he wanted, he could have. Like, you know, and that's why, you know, he didn't carry money. He was constantly losing his wallet. He borrowed money from me, and I had to ask Jackie. You asked him to ask Jackie to give it back to me, you know, stupid $40. But at that time, it was a big deal. I mean, he just, you know, people paid for him. He didn't carry money. He lost money. He never, you know, he always had the best this and the best that, the best clothes and the best, you know, Andy Warhol was his friend. You know, it's just like the people he hung out with, you know, so why would the normal rules of life apply to him? I mean, you know, if he wanted to go kayaking in the Arctic, he kayaked in the Arctic. If he wanted to go kayaking in, you know, in the sea, you know, in South Sweden, he'd do that, or you know, go to, you know, kayaking in the Caribbean and almost die. That's the way it was with John. You know, it was all good. You know, he was a high beta guy. You know, he was like kind of living life to the fullest. He was having a great time. You know, he would go to Studio 54 with all these models, and you know, he'd end up with Bruce Springsteen's wife's phone number in his pocket. And he would go to a opening of a movie with the freaking movie stars, and all the cameras would be on him, not on the movie stars. So he just believed, and I don't blame him, that the normal rules just didn't apply to him. And so they didn't apply except one time. And, you know, it was fatal.
Now, in terms of the rules not applying to him, do you think he relished that? Or was there any part of him that kind of wanted to have a more normal existence?
I think there was a little of both. I mean, he couldn't escape it. If your name is John F. Kennedy Jr., there's no escaping who you are and your legacy. So, I mean, part of him loved that because everybody was worshiping him and fawning over him and giving him tickets to this and that and you name it. Whatever he wanted, he could have, okay? So, and often without even paying for it. So a part of him relished that, but I mean, you know, the other part of him, I think over time, got sick of it and needed an escape and needed a place to be by himself, you know, which is why he may have gone kayaking in the Arctic, which seems like a story to me that's apocryphal, but I guess it's true. And, you know, why he took up flying, because, you know, up in the sky in his plane that he was piloting, you know, there was nobody around him, nobody to bother him. So he literally needed to fly to get away from what was going on down on the earth.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. Yeah. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
Can you tell us a little more about those kayaking trips? It sounds like he was obsessed.
Totally. He was totally obsessed with kayaking.
Yeah.
I mean, which is, who's obsessed with kayaking? I know there are people who like kayaking, right? I mean, it's such a weird sport or whatever. Obviously, it's very physical and very exciting to be, you know, in a kayak, either with yourself or one other person or whatever. You know, I don't know where that necessarily came from, because he certainly wasn't doing that in Andover. And I don't know where he would have done it in Brown, but maybe, you know, off the roiling waters of Providence, Rhode Island. I don't know, but he became became obsessed with it when he moved to New York and, you know, lived down in Tribeca and would keep his kayak and go off with his friends to go kayaking in the Hudson, which was, of course, incredibly dangerous, both from a currents perspective and, you know, the kind of boats that would go up, you know, in the Hudson. So then, of course, he took it to the, you know, next increasingly dangerous, you know, levels, almost dying on his trip to the Caribbean with his then girlfriend, going with his buddies again to Scandinavia. And, you know, it's so interesting because he wrote about that trip in a like an op-ed in the New York Times, and again, how he almost died. And the names of the people that he went with, you know, I never recognized one of those names. Not one. And, you know, you Google them, and there's, like, something that seems like those names. And I don't know whether it was all just John and a bunch of his friends who, and they changed all the names, or just this obscure group of people that he went with. I just didn't understand it. It's sort of like the Arctic trip, which, again, obviously a very close friend of his who told me about it, and she told me that he came back with a bunch of baby whale bones that she made into a chandelier, you know, for him that's was in Jackie's house in Martha's Vineyard. But, I mean, there's no record of him going to the Arctic on a kayak trip by himself. I mean, and how stupid can you possibly be to go to the Arctic by yourself on a kayak trip? I mean, literally 1 second in that water and you're dead. I mean, and so I don't know. I don't know about these trips, but apparently they're true. So I just wrote about them because they were true enough, I guess.
Do you think that maybe John exaggerated these things to kind of make a myth for himself?
Again, I don't think so. I don't think so. But on the other hand, both the trip to Scandinavia, where, again, he almost died, seems hard to believe. Again, I didn't recognize any of those names, and I still haven't really figured out who those people are. Yet he wrote about it in the New York Times, so unless he conned the New York Times, that must have been real. The trip to the Arctic I find unbelievable, because who would be so stupid? And yet, you know, this mutual friend of ours said not only did it happen, but she made this sculpture for him, you know, for his mother, out of the baby whale bones that he brought back, that he found on this small little island that he landed on. So I don't know. And in the Caribbean, where he almost died too, that was written about in his girlfriend's book. So that must have been true. So just another day in the life of JFK Jr.
We've talked about John's school life and about his hobbies. I want to talk about his career a little bit, and specifically George Magazine. I'm interested in getting your take on it because you've worked in finance and as a magazine writer. And here's a guy who had no background in publishing and no background in business. It seems like there's a decent argument to be made that John had no business launching a magazine, right?
Yeah, of course not, except if you're John F. Kennedy Jr. And then anything that you conceive of doing, what's the only impediment is that you didn't think of it. So the moment you've thought of it, then there's no impediment anymore. And you connect with Michael Berman, who has some knowledge of finance and access to venture capital. You know, and you show up with John F. Kennedy Jr. talking about wanting to start a political magazine that's going to be sort of satirical and fun, where you're going to make politicians into celebrities. And by the way, you're going to have access to them for stories, and they're going to write for you. I mean, who's going to say no to that? You know, this is sort of the heyday of, you know, big magazines where they're making money hand over fist in the pre-internet days, pre-social media days. So, no, of course he had no business doing it, but, you know, John Kennedy Jr., so of course I'm going to do it.
Yeah, now, I mean, on the one hand, George was kind of a product of its times. Clinton had just been elected, and politics kind of suddenly seemed cool. But I'm struck by how relevant it feels today. Do you think it's possible that maybe George was actually ahead of its time?
Absolutely, George was ahead of its time. I mean, he was not a visionary, so don't get that impression. But he came up with an idea that was ahead of its time. And by the way, you know, again, as I talk about in the book, he was pretty much done with it because the magazine was losing money. He and Michael, of course, had split. And I think he was pretty much done with it and wanted to move on to politics and was gearing up for that.
Now, William, in writing the book, you spoke to a lot of people who knew Carolyn, and she comes across as a pretty volatile person. Can you say a little bit more about that and about Carolyn?
Obviously, I'd never met her, so this is kind of like third hand. So, I mean, John, obviously, I knew and knew well. First-hand knowledge. This is third-hand knowledge. So all I can say is she seemed to be ambitious personally and ambitious in her relationships. It seemed that snagging a guy like John was on her agenda, and she fulfilled that agenda. But once she reached the top of the mountain with John, I think she just fell apart and couldn't handle his stardom and their stardom.
Yeah.
And I think suffered from some forms of depression and mental illness and took refuge in drugs and people who were not John, and I think just sort of fell apart and couldn't handle it and was a tragic figure for John, for herself, incredibly beautiful, right? I mean, just you could see why he would fall for her.
Yeah.
And a distinct look, more than just beautiful. I mean, just she was dashing and charming, but volatile and, hot to handle. And I think by the end, by 1999, realized that it was over. Definitely, definitely over. And how to extricate himself from it was very much on the agenda.
Someone you spoke to said there were two Johns, one before he met Carolyn and one after. Do you think there's truth to that?
Well, then I've also spoke to people who said there were two Johns, one before he was named the sexiest man on earth and one after he was named the sexiest man on earth. So, I mean, I didn't see John. I mean, last time I saw John was when he was dating Daryl Hannah. And we ran into each other at Columbus Circle, and he was supposed to go to meet Daryl at the movie theater down below. And instead of going down to see Daryl, he was already late, because, of course, John was late for everything. He spent a half hour talking to me. I mean, it was ridiculous. I said, John, what are you doing here? Well, I'm supposed to go see Daryl, you know, go to the movies. But now, oh, look at this, I'm 45 minutes late. Oh, I said, John, what are you... I mean, so... You know, so I didn't really know him after he got married to her. So, you know, I don't know. I think that she made him sad. I think she freaked him out. I think that he was hoping for some sort of like Camelot like love story, and I think she was just too difficult and cheated on him, and he knew it. You know, wouldn't have any physical relationship with him. So it's kind of all unraveling there.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is?
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10 to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
You mentioned earlier John's love of flying, and you do a fantastic job in the book of chronicling his lifelong obsession with planes. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, again, I think the origin was just this need to escape his frustrations and the limelight that accompanied him wherever he went. And, you know, I don't blame him for that. It began during the summer when he was... out in, you know, Wyoming, and then he worked at the ranch of the Grateful Dead guy who was into flying and let John fly his plane. And I think it just went from there. And, you know, there were periods of time where he wouldn't fly because, of course, Jackie didn't want him to fly, let alone pilot his own plane. But it obviously accelerated in a big way as he got older and after she died. Well, the other interesting thing that I hadn't ever really figured out until I wrote this book is that, of course, every, you know, November, you know, 22nd, the anniversary of his father's assassination, he always got out of New York. He always got out of town. And so one of the things that he did a few of those times is go out to this place in whatever, Iowa, to get this sort of whirlybird contraption. He had one, and then he upgraded it for him and Carolyn, and, you know, so that both of this Buckeye thing that they could both be on and fly around. And then he loved doing that, which is, of course, insanely risky and dangerous. But, of course, he loved that. And so then the natural evolution, of course, is your own plane. And then, of course, you need a faster, bigger, better plane that turns out to be more plane than you can handle or know how to fly.
One of the things we mentioned in our series is that John had a cast on his leg up until the week of his last flight. Can you tell us about how he hurt himself?
Yeah, he had a bunch of friends around. It was the beginning of Memorial Day weekend. Mm-hmm. Beautiful day on Martha's Vineyard over at, you know, his mother's farm, 500 acres in Gayhead. I mean, you know, he was there loving life. He goes up in this whirlybird machine, whatever you call it, and comes crashing down, and he broke his ankle/leg, you know, was in a cast the whole summer, which of course really pissed him off, and he couldn't, you know, bike, he couldn't run, he couldn't fly. And then he, you know, comes back to New York, gets his cast off. The doctor tells him, you know, not to fly because you need your legs to fly. And the, you know, the first thing he does is go up in the plane with his wife, who he wasn't getting along with, of course. This is sort of a reconciliation mission, and his wife's sister. And so the plane was too much for him. He shouldn't have been flying that day to begin with, not only because of the weather and the lateness of the hour and the humidity, etc., mm-hmm. but his, you know, physically he shouldn't have been flying because he just had his cast off on his broken leg. I mean, John, you're an idiot. Why did you do any of those things?
So it sounds like you're a little bit angry at him for taking so many risks, one of which obviously ultimately turned out to be fatal.
And I'm not the only one. Ed Hill, who I quote extensively in the book, he was close with John starting at Andover and then throughout his whole life. He was, you know, rip shit at John. Again, I'm angrier now than I sort of was when I started writing the book because I didn't know any of these things, right? And I just saw this pattern of silly risk-taking that just made no sense to me. So that's just selfish and stupid and irresponsible, right? And then when you marry all of that with the fact that literally he was getting ready to run for governor of New York and probably would have won. And by 2016, I think he would have been ready to run for president. And we could have had John Kennedy Jr. be the president of the United States now instead of Donald Trump. And so, yeah, am I angry about that? Yes.
So, as you mentioned, your book is not only about John, it's also about three other people from your time at Andover. But it's really a book about friendship, which comes in a lot of shapes and sizes. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the nature of friendship and what it has meant in your life.
Well, it's about friendship, and I have a lot of deep, ongoing, meaningful friendships from my time at Andover. So it was about that and also the fragility of life, right? When you're 17, you know, you really don't think about the fragility of life. You know, I'm now 60. Now I think about it. And writing this book, of course, made me think about it. And each one of these guys, literally each one of them, went out in the morning thinking it was going to be just another day, and it turned out to be their last day. And that's sort of a unifying experience of the book. And I just, you know, thinking about that and how, you know, you go out in the morning and you just think it's another day, and it could be your last. And, you know, writing about their last moments as best as I could do it, was really, I mean, it was riveting for me to explore it, and riveting for me to talk to people about it, and riveting for me to write it. And I hope riveting for people to read, but I don't know that. So,
well, for what it's worth, I felt it was riveting. Mm. So I think
that's nice to hear.
It was a great read for me. Yeah, it was. And I think there's something powerful and profound about writing about the end of someone's life. So I think that you did it very eloquently, and I enjoyed mm-hmm. reading it.
Wow. William, that's all we have for you. And okay. we both want to yeah. say thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
From Wondery, this is Even the Rich. Thanks again to William Cohen. You can grab a copy of his book, Four Friends, wherever books are sold. On our next episode, we're bringing you a brand new story about Britney Spears and the ongoing fight to end her conservatorship.
I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. Our producer is Caleb Bissinger. Audio assistance by Sergio Enriquez. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.